Musk could still make the changes that many people hope for, or...?
Quite frankly, I don't believe this somewhat saviour is coming to amplify our voices on a somewhat crusader mission, amplifying our voices on Twitter because of our campaigning for the human rights of Palestinian people, as we clearly see accounts such as Noura Erekat being permanently suspended, if I'm not mistaken. But now, after successful pressure, her account has now been restored. As long as individuals and organisations continue to platform online to defend and call for the human rights and expose the Israeli war crimes being committed in Palestine, we are going to see the Israeli lobby use its utmost effort on such platforms to silence individuals, which we have seen with Noura Erekat being one, and as the film mentioned earlier, other organisations.
I mean, it's probably worth pressurising Musk, though, isn't it, given his alleged commitment to freedom of speech, and sort of hold him to account on that, do you think?
And I believe that will be a testament of time.
Yeah.
In the sense, if in when we're focusing on Palestine, with this new Israeli government that have said individuals within the government calling to be the landlords of their very own country, it will only be a testament of time to find out whether individuals, as well as organisations that continue to campaign for the human rights belonging to an oppressed people, will have their voices silenced.
Well, look, David, I mean, just tell us what the story is with the middleman for this Twitter deal, Ari Emanuel.
So Emanuel is referred to as a Hollywood super agent. He represents a huge list of A-list celebrities in L.A. and Hollywood. But he was called in to broker the deal when it looked like the deal was going south. Musk put in the offer and then withdrew the offer, and Emanuel was brought in to broker the deal. Now, he's close to Musk. Musk was at his wedding earlier this year, and indeed went on holiday with him in a Greek island off Mykonos as well. So and he is a part of the Emanuel family. He has two brothers, Zeke and Ram, both of whom are quite prominent in US politics, both of them strong Zionists, all three of them in the Democratic Party. But Rahm Emanuel is so hardline on Israel that Donald Trump actually funded one of his political campaigns. Yeah. But Ari is the agent in this case. Their father was a guy called Benjamin, right, who was in the Ergun, who was involved in arms smuggling for the Ergun, and allegedly involved in various assassinations and terror attacks in the process of the creation of the State of Israel. And Ari Emanuel himself, of course, regularly is involved with the Friends of the IDF and raising huge sums of money that they raise at their gala dinners. They spend millions of dollars every year to the IDF to support Israeli war crimes. So there's a clear sense there that in the milieu in which he operates, there's a very strong Zionist influence.
What about this alliance with this character, Murray Weiss? I mean, what do you know about that?
Well, that's more complicated, I think, because she was brought in to do the Twitter files, and there's been some really interesting stuff in the Twitter files, and it's well worth having a look.
Which, obviously, a credit, I suppose, to Musk in actually releasing
indeed, those. Indeed. It's worth having a look at in depth. But she quickly fell out with him, right, over his statements about journalists, and so they got into a big spat. So although she's kind of she sort of cancelled herself from the New York Times, claiming there was all this anti-Semitism, you know, usual fake allegations. But then she's now been appointed by Musk to this role, and very quickly fell out with him about his arguments over journalists. So it's an interesting thing to see how this develops.
It'll be interesting to see how it develops. But we're going to just pause there for a moment, because we want to just have a look now at a report on how Elon Musk's been involved in launching satellites for the Zionist regime.
From his very inception, Elon Musk's project SpaceX was very close to the CIA, enjoying support and investment from Mike Griffin, president at venture capital firm InQtel. But InQtel is not any venture capital firm. It's a CIA operation that cultivates companies to work with a national security state. Mike Griffin later went on to NASA, where he further assisted Musk in his ascent. Over the years, Musk's company has made billions on contracts to transport spy satellites, which aid in drone warfare and the gathering of military intelligence. One such customer has been U.S. arms firm Lockheed Martin, which gave Musk $500 million in 2018 to launch their GPS system. SpaceX was contracted by the U.S. Air Force to launch the command satellite, through which it maps targets. Musk also launched the spy satellites for the National Reconnaissance Office, which are used by both the NSA and CIA. Elon Musk later assisted the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, by providing his Starlink satellites for use by the Ukrainian military against the Russian army. It is believed the satellites allow the Ukrainian forces to target using thermal imaging, even in harsh conditions. We now also know that Musk and his Starlink satellites are active in the regime change operation against Iran. When US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken commented on the need for the US government to aid the flow of information in Iran, Musk personally responded to the tweet with the words, "Activating Starlink." He later tweeted the words, "Approaching 100 Starlinks active in Iran." Musk's collaboration with Israel against the resistance axis has taken an ominous turn. Recently, Musk's company, SpaceX, quietly launched spy satellites for the gathering of military intelligence for an Israeli intelligence company called ImageSat International. The CEO of the company, Noam Sigal, is a current reserve in the Israeli Air Force. The chief of marketing at the company is Barak Salamin, an active duty officer in the Israeli Air Force. The company is full of former and current Israeli military figures, as well as former employees of Israeli arms company Elbit Systems. Musk's collaborator ImageSat International has been a key component of Israeli airstrikes on Syria, and it's likely this launch serves a similar purpose. Both the company and the Israeli embassy in the US publicly thanked Musk and SpaceX on Twitter for facilitating the launch, a fitting tribute.
David, Elon Musk's SpaceX company is portrayed as a benign project that's focused on enhancing our understanding of the solar system and the wider universe. But I wonder if you could say something about its role in developing a kind of global surveillance infrastructure.
Well, let's remember that Musk's fortune is based in part on huge sums of money from the military-industrial complex. Whatever your views on politics or free speech, and he appears to have some kind of vaguely libertarian ideas, that's an anchor for how you will conduct yourself. You can't leave that anchor behind, because that's where you get your wealth from. So this is the key thing here. We've got to look at where the money comes from and how he is anchored economically as opposed to ideologically to the military-industrial complex. Now, the military-industrial complex in this case is predominantly US imperialism and is involved in global surveillance of populations which might pose a threat to US interests. Now, of course, that's, as we speak today, in Iran, in Syria, in Somalia, and various other places, right? So that's what his interests are, even though he might have a set of ideas which cut against those interests in some respects. So that's where we should be directing attention. And you see that in the involvement with the Israelis. You know, putting up satellites which are allowing Israeli, effectively, war crimes in the thousands of bombing raids they've done. There's 1,000 now on Syria in the last few years. These are against international law. They shouldn't be occurring. And Musk is facilitating them.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, of course, and I remember when the coup in Bolivia took place, he tweeted out, you know, we will coup whoever we want to, didn't he? Which sort of gives away some of his where his sympathies perhaps lie. But Abraham, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what you know about this organisation, ImageSat International, that Elon Musk has worked with recently.
So essentially, ImageSat International is an Israeli intelligence firm, surveillance firm, whereby it's made up of, as the film showed us, members that have illustrious history, illustrious backgrounds in the Israeli military and private arms Israeli companies such as that of Elbit Systems. And essentially what ImageSat International is that it takes pictures in colour and has been found in the past of taking pictures within Syria and providing coordinates to the Israeli Air Force to then later carry out strikes. As David just mentioned, in the last 5 years, at least 1,000 airstrikes have been carried out by Israel into Syria, which only makes us question how many other countries in that region alone are they surveying, spying on, providing coordinates for, not only within the Middle East, but across the entire world?
I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Musk's assisting the Israeli war on the axis of resistance by launching these satellites containing hardware made by the notorious Elbit Systems. I mean, and we've covered the campaigns against Elbit on this show on a number of occasions before. But I wonder whether you could sort of update us really on what the latest is on the struggle against Elbit in the UK.
Well, just in case for first-time viewers, Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest private arms companies. They produce the drones that survey and kill Palestinians, and Palestine Action, which is an organization that carries out direct action against Elbit Systems, is carrying out the Shut Down Elbit campaign, whereby they have already shut down a factory as well as Elbit's HQ in the heart of central London, and have cost Israel's war machine millions by applying pressure upon the pressure points of this monolithic structure, as it somewhat appears to be. As it currently stands, there are many activists within Palestine Action that have caught this month and throughout the year of 2023, and we must ensure that we do our utmost effort to support these individuals that have cost Israel's, one of Israel's largest private arms companies, millions. Mm. It's held them accountable to the countless war crimes it has committed in the Gaza Strip, the countless children, women, men, elderly, as well as those retaining physical and mental disabilities. Yeah. So we must be there as an act of support.
Sure, sure. I mean, David, Musk's involved in the regime change operation in Iran, isn't he, as well?
Well, he has this Starlink thing, isn't it, which is a means of communications which bypasses the internet or mobile phone signals to enable those who are involved in the riots and the subversion in Iran to try and communicate with Western sources. So, yes, he's been involved in that, and that's been, probably quite important in the attempt to foment the riots in Iran, but of course, overall, those attempts have failed. I mean, there's an attempt to do this in the last few months, but these have now failed, and it's not looking like it was a success. But certainly, he was involved in that, and that's an indication again of his orientation towards the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about the Starlinks that you mentioned there. I mean, he's also had some input into the war in Ukraine as well, hasn't he? I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, and the same thing there, Starlink's there. But the interesting thing in Ukraine was his kind of ambiguous position on this. He's much more sympathetic to Russia, it seems, than you would expect from someone from that kind of background. And he threatened the Ukrainians that he was going to withdraw the Starlinks unless they paid for them. And they were outraged at the idea that they'd have to pay. And they were also complaining they weren't working properly. He said, well, you want them to work properly? Pay me the money. Yeah. And that's an interesting little kind of detail. But yes, he has been involved in that. And that appears to be continuing. But nevertheless, there's an ambiguity there about his relationship with Russia.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Ibrahim, looking forward as a young Palestinian journalist, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what your hopes are for Twitter as a means of expression.
I think first thing we have to do, Chris, is understand the reality that we live in today and how likely could there be a Palestinian journalist from a working class background or anybody that isn't white, upper class, a male, within that demographic, using such platforms, whether it be that to even go to university, to particular occupations and particular jobs. I think what we really need to do is understand that we're in a particular position of power, and it could go even more some. I'm not trying to say that the position we're in now is I'm happy with it, but what we have to do is use Twitter and the tools that we have, capitalize on them, amplify our voices, ensure that this reality in our parents' generation alone was not a likelihood that could have happened, and how globalized we are and how connected we are in today's day and age. What is our excuse? When we are seeing people gather en masse in millions of numbers before an age of WhatsApp, before an age of Instagram, before an age where I can find out the war crimes that are happening in the Gaza Strip just before I lay my head to rest. What is our excuse in towards mobilizing? What is our excuse into using it as a means of expression?
Yeah, I mean, David, just finally and briefly, I wonder whether you could, just following up on, on what Ibrahim was saying there and just Twitter in general and being used as a tool, but it's also been used in a kind of negative way to kind of close down, pro-Palestinian voices. And I wonder whether you could maybe just list some of the organisations. We've touched on this a little bit in the past with organisations like CST and so on and the actions that, that they've taken, lobbying Twitter to try and close down limit people like ourselves, you and I.
I think Twitter and social media in general is an ambiguous thing. These are dominated by Western corporations who have over close relationships with both the military industrial complex and with intelligence agencies, and thus also with Zionist lobby groups. But there are alternatives emerging. Alternatives emerging in Russia and China and various places, and that's also critically important for the future. But lastly, the thing I would say is remember that mobile phones are also used for surveillance, and they're also used for targeting people in situations of conflict. So we can't be too optimistic about the possibilities of technology, because they have negative.
Definitely pros and cons. Unfortunately, as ever, we've run out of time, but I'm afraid so we're going to have to leave it there. I hope you found this program informative again, and I want to thank our guests, Ibrahim Abul Esed, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. I thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In California, at least 19 people have died as the storms continue to batter the region, leading to widespread flooding, mudslides, and power outages. The National Weather Service says large portions of Central California have received over half of their annual normal precipitation in just the past 2 weeks, and more rain is coming. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says 34 million Californians are under a flood watch. Despite the devastating impacts, few media outlets have drawn a connection between the historic weather and human-induced climate change. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote in this regard, a new report reveals the devastating cost of extreme weather events in the United States last year, with 18 events resulting in costs over $1 billion each and hundreds of lives lost. In total, 474 people in the U.S. died in 2022 due to those 18 weather events, according to a report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Last year placed third for the highest number of disasters recorded in a calendar year, NOAA said on its website. The 2 years that saw a higher number of billion-dollar weather events were both recent. In 2021, there were 20 such events, and in 2020, there were 22. Though previous years have had a greater number of billion-dollar extreme weather events, 2022 was more costly. Damages from these disasters totaled approximately $165 billion for all 18 events, NOAA said, noting that in the year prior, the total cost was $155.3 billion. The severe weather events included hurricanes, flooding, winter storms, tornadoes, droughts, and more. Hurricane Ian was the most expensive of the 18 events in NOAA's report, costing $112.9 billion, the third most expensive hurricane since the agency started recording costs in 1980. Over the past 7 years, NOAA noted there have been over 122 separate billion-dollar weather-related disasters, with financial costs exceeding $1 trillion total. At least 5,000 people died as a result of these disasters. Although the report doesn't mention climate change, scientists from NOAA have said that the climate crisis is responsible for the increase in extreme weather events in the U.S. and around the world. The frequency and severity of extreme climate events continue to increase, NOAA Administrator Rick Spinard said on Twitter, adding, "Today's stats underscore why we must build our resiliency to these costly events and become a climate-ready nation." In an email to Truthout, NOAA applied climatologist Adam Smith confirmed that the rise in extreme weather events is the result of climate crisis. Climate change is supercharging the increasing frequency and intensity of certain types of extreme weather that lead to billion-dollar disasters, most notably the rise in vulnerability to drought, lengthening wildfire seasons in western United States, and the potential for extremely heavy rainfall becoming more common in the eastern states. Smith said, "Given all these compounding hazard risks, there is an increased need to focus on where we build, how we build, and investing in infrastructure updates that are designed for 21st century climates." Other organizations and experts noted that becoming climate ready isn't enough. To lessen the frequency and severity of these events, the U.S. and other wealthy nations must act to reduce emissions. To curtail the worst climate and extreme weather disasters, major emitting nations must take drastic actions to rein in global warming emissions, a statement from the Union of Concerned Statistics said. Policymakers must also invest equitably in climate adaptation measures. Rachel Klotas, the policy director for Climate and Energy Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists, told NPR, "This sobering data paints a dire picture of how woefully unprepared the United States is to cope with the mounting climate crisis and its intersection with other socioeconomic challenges in people's daily lives. Rather than responding in a one-off manner to disasters within the U.S., Congress should implement a comprehensive national climate resilience strategy commensurate the harm and risks we are already facing in the U.S." According to recent reports, in California, at least 19 people have died as the storms continue to batter the region, leading to widespread flooding, mudslides, and power outages. Thousands of residents have been ordered to evacuate in some areas, including parts of Santa Barbara and Monterey County. 5 million people in California remain under a flood watch. The National Weather Service says large portions of Central California have received over half their annual normal precipitation in just the past 2 weeks, and more rain is coming. Santa Cruz County Supervisor Zach Friend has described the storms as a, quote, "once in a generational challenging event." In San Miguel, California, the National Guard has joined in the effort to find a 5-year boy named Kyle Doan, who was swept away by the flood waters recently. Meteorologists say California is being hit with what's known as an atmospheric river of rain, which has unleashed unrelenting storms. Meanwhile, Media Matters reports national TV news in largely ignoring the link between climate change and the deluge devastating California. The group looked at 60 segments that aired on national TV news networks between December 31st and January 4th. Only one mentioned climate change. To talk more about the storms in California, Daniel Swain, climate scientist at UCLA, said that the Media Matters reports national TV news is largely ignoring the link between climate change and the deluge devastating the U.S. state of California.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing domestic politics in Saudi Arabia with author and journalist Ali Al-Ahmad. But first, this brief analysis.
The fact that the country is named after the ruling family gives us insight into the basic reality of the so-called nation-state. Indeed, it highlights that Saudi Arabia is actually not a nation-state in the traditional sense, even though it is treated as such in international relations, but rather a family business established by Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman Ali Saud with the help of the British in the early 20th century in order to destabilize, divide, and conquer the Ottoman Empire, culminating in the establishment of what is today called Saudi Arabia in 1932, when Abdulaziz conquered and annexed the Kingdom of Hejaz, which includes Islam's holiest cities of Mecca and Medina, contrary to the wishes of Abdulaziz's British benefactors. This action by Abdulaziz might have something to do with the fact that American oil companies discovered oil just 2 years prior to this Saudi attack on Hejaz in the Shia-majority eastern Persian Gulf Coast region, which the Saud had conquered and devastated 15 years prior to that. This makes Saudi Arabia the only country in the region whose oil was always directly under U.S. control from the very beginning and never under British control. A matter which bothered the British for years, as shown in later declassified documents from that era. The absolute monarchy of Saudi Arabia has been passed on after the death of Abdulaziz in 1953 until today, from one of his sons to another, from half-brother to half-brother. This being possible because he had so many sons that there are debates about how many he actually sired. The most common figure mentioned being around 50. This is, however, all changing now as his son Salman, the current monarch, has appointed his son Muhammad as the crown prince and heir apparent, trying to establish the monarchy in his own line of descendants and excluding the approximately 5,000 other Saudi princes from the royal succession in perpetuity. Muhammad bin Salman has already shown his family values before becoming king, when he arrested dozens of his most influential cousins and imprisoned them in a luxury hotel until they pledged allegiance and transferred billions of dollars of their wealth to him. Muhammad bin Salman's irrational actions on the international scene, such as beginning the genocidal war on Yemen, kidnapping, murder, and literal butchering of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, or kidnapping, beating, and forced televised resignation of former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, have brought more unwanted attention to the rule of the Al Saud in these few years than in all the 70 years prior to that. Prior to Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudis maintained a media policy of not being spoken about in the media, a policy enforced for decades by bribing and buying, or when necessary, threatening, imprisoning, and killing journalists, dissidents, and media owners around the world. The family rule of the Al Saud is entering uncharted territory as the family business is passing from the brother's generation to the cousin's generation and the attempt to consolidate the monarchy in the Salman line. There has never been a real national feeling in this nation named after a family, with many regions maintaining their distinct identity. Regions such as Hejaz, or the Shia-majority Persian Gulf Coast, or the southern regions of Najran, Asir, and Jizan, which have historically, culturally, and religiously always been part of Yemen, and were part of the regions conquered and annexed by Abdul Aziz in the 20th century. It remains to be seen if the next generation of people on the Arabian Peninsula will forego their natural right to self-determination and elected government and passively accept continued absolute monarchy and the concentration of biblical levels of wealth in the hands of the Al Saud family in return for being allowed to celebrate Halloween or to occasionally attend the concerts of scantily dressed female pop singers. And if history is a guide, it is improbable that this tribal family rule, dressed up as a nation-state, will survive in its current form.
Ali Al Ahmad, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You're joining us from Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And I'm very glad that you accepted our invitation, because we want to talk about Saudi Arabia, a subject which, if you look at the way it's treated in the mainstream media in the West, it's always done in a very bad way. It's done in a way where either they don't talk about Saudi Arabia or they do it in a very caricature way. And with your permission, I want to focus our conversation on the domestic internal realities that exist in Saudi Arabia, because I believe that this is an area where we have very little information and very little analysis that's been done. And of course, we always try to talk to persons who are from the country that we're talking about. So alhamdulillah, we have a chance to talk to you about these issues. So who are the ones in Washington who are really behind Mohammed bin Salman?
In Washington, people who are extremely loyal to Israel, mm-hmm. The organizations related. For example, you talk about IPAC and its
right.
Offsprings, organizations and politicians, and Netanyahu loyalists and Netanyahu supporters. Those and some new conservative, not all, want this relationship between Mohammed bin Salman or the Saudi state and Israel, and that's all they care about.
Right.
So to them, nothing else matters. Murders, killing, it doesn't matter. He's wonderful as long as he is doing what's good for Israel. And I think the steps that Mohammed bin Salman honestly did helped Israel, like Sisi, for example, when they had the
right.
transfer of the islands from Egypt to Saudi Arabia. The number one benefactor of this is Israel,
exactly.
because now they have access to the northern Red Sea, so they can just go through international waters without having to go through shallow waters between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And they don't have to pay the Egyptians anything or request permission.
Right. So let's look a little bit more to other players, to other groups in Saudi Arabia. We talked a little bit about Al Saud. If there's anything else you want to add about Al Saud, please go ahead.
I'm saying that the Al Saud people think that all of them have interest in politics. Most of them are, you know, I've met dozens of them. A lot of them, they are extremely, they understand that they want to keep the regime. They might dislike Mohammed bin Salman, but at the time that anything threatens the regime, they will not do it, because it means that they will go down too, because they are still princes receiving special treatment and receiving salaries. So Mohammed bin Salman, yes, he cracked down on many of his cousins, but they continue to receive at least a minimum the status and the money and the sort of this luxurious life. So I don't think they want to throw it away, and some of them are willing to just forgo fighting Mohammed bin Salman, and they have paid loyalty. I remember when one of them is Bandar bin Sultan, who has a lot of power. He actually went to the palace after Mohammed bin Salman became, and he said, "This is all the money I have. Take it. Whatever you want, I'm under your service." Same thing Mohammed bin Fahd did. Mm-hmm. And they were rewarded for this. They both came and they basically said, "We are at your service. Here is the money, and take anything you want." They did not fight it. They did not. And he took the a lot of money, but also he kept something for them. And that's why he rewarded Bandar bin Sultan by appointing his daughter, who mm-hmm. is not very smart, right, as an ambassador here, and his son in London, and Mohammed bin Fahd appointing his son as an advisor in the palace. So not everyone is going to fight Mohammed bin Salman. The King Abdullah's children, some of them are in the United Kingdom, but at the same time, they are not coming out publicly. They might try to do things here and there, but mostly it's a grumbling. And this is nothing new. The Al Saud, the brother of King Salman, his older brother, Turki, was in Egypt for 30 years,
right,
because he was upset, and he died there, and nothing happened. So I would not want to pin any hopes mm-hmm. that the monarchy itself will start fighting. This is what destroyed the second, so-called the second Saudi state, but I don't think this is going to be the case here. It might be a factor that there will be infighting, definitely. But I think the demise of this current regime will come in a different manner.
Right.
And it will mostly be from the people. I just wanted to highlight one thing here. Regarding the Saudi ruling clans infighting, mm-hmm. Just last year, the personal bodyguard of King Salman, who was also the personal bodyguard of King Abdullah,
yes,
was killed. He was killed by Mohammed bin Salman, because there was a plot to kill Mohammed bin Salman.
Okay, so let's go now, because it seems to me you're saying that if change is going to happen, it's going to come from outside the Al Saud. So yes, let's take a look. You mentioned Al-Ghahtani. Could you give us maybe some insight into who are some of the, as you mentioned, national figures, some of those who are considered maybe on a higher level than some, as you mentioned, lower level political prisoners that are highlighted. So if you could mention maybe some of those people for us, for the audience who might not be familiar with what's going on in Saudi Arabia.
One of the things that the Saudi regime did successfully, I have to say, that they prevented this country. In Iran, you have national figures. Right. You have singers, poets, politicians, right, activists, media personalities. In our country, we don't have that. What they did, they divided that country into sort of these sections. You're from the south, you're from the north, you're from the center, you're Shia, you're Sunni, and you're from Hijaz, and so on. So the country has really never come around a figure that they can call, because, if you're from Najd, this guy's from Hijaz. You're Shia, this guy's Sunni. If you're Sunni, this guy's Shia, and so on. So
right. There's not a real national feeling.
They made sure there is not a national figure. And they did it. They do it, with the advice and help of their Western backers in the UK and in Washington. Just this story that has not made a single Western publication. that even, you know, maybe even press TV, that the current Saudi cabinet right now, there was a cabinet shift or a shovel a couple of, like maybe a month and a half ago. Not all the ministers now in that cabinet are from NED, from the center region of Saudi Arabia, from the same background. So there are no, for the first time since the Saudi state, there is not a single minister from the West, from Hijaz.
Right.
There hasn't been a minister from the South, except for 55 days during King Abdullah's time. There hasn't been a single Shia in the cabinet. There hasn't been, you know, a single minister from the North as well. So you and the East, yes, but not from, you know, not, of course not Shia, but very few over the past 90 years. So we're trying to see here is concentration of power, fearing that something is going to happen. And Mohammed bin Salman is very careful about his safety. Mm-hmm. He doesn't go places. He has a lot of bodyguards and security around him. And he uses even foreign mercenaries, Blackwater and others, to play a part in his in protecting him, because he fears, and maybe it's true, that even the CIA tried to get him in 2017. In this mysterious gunfire that took place in 2017 in April, where Riyadh was just, you know, went, there was a lot of gunfire and nobody knew what happened, and they said, "Oh, it's just a drone." It was not a drone. It was an assassination attempt, most likely, you know, supported by Washington or directed by Washington. I'm not sure the information, but it was not a normal event. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this regime is not stable yet.
Right.
So it will not take huge risks in the region. It will keep everybody on their toes, but it will not move toward the Americans like before, vice versa. It might try to get some protection from the Chinese and the Russians and so
right.
on.
So how does the war in Yemen play into all this? Because it seems to me that it's this massive, you know, blunder, a strategic blunder. They were advertising, oh, this is going to be over in 2 weeks, in a month, in 2 months, and it's been years now. And mm-hmm. for the first time, we've had, you know, actually the Yemenis, as I would claim is their right under international law to actually defend themselves. We actually had, you know, the territory of Saudi Arabia being attacked by Yemen in as a defense of the, you know, thousands of airstrikes that have been conducted in Yemen. So how does the war in Yemen play into this instability or this kind of situation that you're describing that's currently happening in Saudi Arabia?
In the war in Yemen, people think that the decision was made in Riyadh. It was not.
Right.
Riyadh was just the one that carried the knife and stabbed the Yemenis in their
right.
back. The name, for those who speak Arabic and understand the Arabic language, even the name of the war that the Saudis used, it was not an Arab name. In Arab, in Balagha, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It was a translation from English. Asifat al-Hazm, the storm resolve. In Arabic, we don't have such an expression. It does not work. Okay,
right.
In Arabic,
it's very clear. It was a direct translation from what the Americans.
It was a direct translation, a poor translation.
Right.
So the decision was announced from Washington, if you remember, by Adel al-Jubeir.
Exactly.
And the Obama administration wanted the Saudis to get involved, to attack, to feel that they you know, the Americans are behind them, and also to make money.
Of course.
I think one of the things that people don't realize that making money for arms companies in the United States and the UK is a big, big motivator for the American and British policies and French policies in the region, because they get two things. They get those lobbyists from the arms dealers and manufacturers to be happy and to fund these politicians, and also strategically if the Americans sell more weapons, that means their factory that creates weapons are going to have more money. They can create better weapons for them. So, and they can and sell the old weapons and right. make new and more advanced weaponry. And that is a strategic decision the Americans have been doing for a long time. So they wanted the Saudis and they thought rightly that Mohammed bin Salman would love this. So and it would also not only drain the Saudi coffers and fatten American and British coffers, because this was a decision that benefited the British. Every bomb that falls in Yemen was loaded by a British national, a mercenary from a British aerodynamic, air systems, BEA systems. And these planes that did most of the bombings are British, made or European made, the Eurofighters and Tornadoes. And so, and of course, the Americans, I know this for a fact, they were in the British and the Americans, the Central Command, were on duty in the Saudi Air Defense Command. And in the command and control center in Saudi Arabia in Riyadh, with their own equipment, so they are connected to CENTCOM directly in Florida, and are able to give the Saudis live information from Yemen. And then when the war started, that's what they did. They gave them pictures, numbers, information, so they can bomb areas and say, here, this is where, this is a target. Here's the information, and they would send it to the Saudi fighter. And the Saudi planes that were flying, they were refueled by American military tankers. And when this became sort of embarrassing, they changed it to a private contractor, American. Private contractor, make more money this way. But the Americans were and continue to be part, the British as well, part of the war, but they didn't want to be in front of it, like Obama says, lead from behind.
Right, and so is it really a case that maybe the leadership in Saudi Arabia, bin Salman, doesn't really want to have this war and he's kind of forced? I mean, couldn't he just say, I'm not going to do this anymore?
I think now he says he thinks that it was a bad move, but at the same time he benefited from it, because during this war, because remember when this war started in 2015, he was not crown prince.
Exactly.
But under he used the war to increase his power, to remove all the other competitors. And during this time of war, people were distracted and people could not speak. As they say in Arabic, when you hear the noise of bullets, everybody's voice is
right.
cannot be heard. So,
well, it seems to me, I mean, what I'm gleaning from your analysis is that if there's going to be some sort of change in Saudi Arabia, you mentioned the idea that there isn't really this kind of national feeling, maybe, because the third Saudi state was built on Abdulaziz going to different areas and basically, conquering them, whether it was, the East in the early 20th century, the Shia majority areas, whether it was the Najran and Asir and Jizan, which were historically Yemeni territories, or whether it was Hejaz in 1932. And it's very interesting because the British were actually quite opposed to Abdulaziz taking over Hejaz.
In the beginning, yes.
Because they felt that this was maybe their area of influence. And then, of course, very famously, that the ruling family from Hejaz went to become the ruling family in Jordan. So it seems to me that if there's going to be some sort of change, it's not going to be on a national level from a national figure that's going to maintain the state other than, can there even be a Saudi Arabia without Al Saud? Wouldn't it seem to be that the different regions would have some sort of a incentive to create their own future, their own political future post Al Saud?
I think, look, realistically, the East, the oil-rich East, and the West, where, you know, Hijaz,
right,
they have no incentives to remain in a political unity with the other parts of the country. The right. center, the central part of the country, is the one that's hungry, that needs resources. And so that's why it makes sure that it controls the other. If you look at the oil sector, and this is completely dominated by the Najdis. And if you look at
even though the oil is in the east, in the Shia majority areas.
Yes. So in Mecca and Medina, the Hijazis are not playing a role, in their own faith. You know, I wrote 22 years ago a massive report about, you know, sort of the religious breakdown in our country. And I noted in that research, I discovered one thing, that the Saudi state, which calls itself Sunni, has systematically and successfully destroyed the Sunni schools of thoughts which dominated Arabia,
exactly,
the Hanafi and Shafi'i and Maliki. If you can ask today anybody, give me the name of a single Shafi'i, Hanafi, or Maliki scholar from Saudi Arabia, you can't, because right. there is not a place of learning for them.
Right.
Their view on culture has been decimated. It's actually almost a crime if you want to become a Maliki or a Shafi'i or Hanafi scholar in Saudi Arabia. In fact, just a few months ago, one of the remaining Maliki scholars from Al-Hasa mm-hmm. in the East died where? In Turkey.
Yes.
He lived in Turkey. And I did not even know he existed, because this is how much censorship on the. So what I'm trying to say is the Saudi state has those regions and who are not did not have a good experience from the government, and sometimes from social and even sometimes dissidents right now in the dissident community. So they are they don't have a lot of incentives in staying in the same unity with because if they have the oil in the east, why share it? You know, exactly. Keep it for ourselves. We haven't been allowed to the benefit of that oil for 90 years. Now we can take it for ourselves and not share it. The same thing with Mecca and Medina. Like I was saying,
right.
I tell you of a conversation that happened and was told to me by a prominent person from Hijaz, where they spoke to the king, King Fahd, about that Mecca at the time did not have a single imam or Masjid al-Haram or Masjid al-Nabawi. All the imams who led prayers are from Najd, they're Wahhabis.
Right.
You know what he told them? He's like, don't you guys make the prayer call? We let you right. do the prayer call. So this is how they viewed the Hijazis, like, oh, you know, you should be happy with just, you know,
right.
because your culture, your voice, your tone, and we can go on and on about this, even when it comes to music. You know, I can tell you a story that happened in Washington here, not far from here, actually, where I'm living. That happened in 1990, in December, I believe. Bandar bin Sultan met with some activists who lived in, you know, they are my friends. They're from the east of Shia. So, and this is what he said. He said, like, we don't have any problem with the Shia. In my office when I was a military officer, the cleaning guy was Shia, and he had right. the key to my office.
Right, exactly.
That's
no problem.
That's how they think.
Yes. No problem.
That, like that Shia guy clean my office, then I'm fine, and we don't have a problem.
Exactly.
There's no Shia mayors, single Shia, not a single Shia mayor in Saudi Arabia. Mayor.
Yes. Yes.
A diplomat, no diplomats, no officers.
Of course.
No Shia mosque in Riyadh.
Hey.
This is something I want to start talking about. So.
Yes. Just my last question, and that's it, and then we finish, inshallah. I just want to ask you, inshallah, for at the end of our conversation, just to give us a brief look into the future. Because, you know, as we said, the Americans are hoping that Mohammed bin Salman will be ruling for the next 50 years. How do you see the next 10, 20 years? Is it going to survive? Will the Saudi state survive? Will there be something else maybe in the future than what it is today?
Well, I hope not. But from analysis point of view, my hopes, I think, are also are right, because it's not sustainable at this time and age to have a regime that basically allow a person, because he is the son of somebody, to rule a country without challenge. Young people are worldly, they know a lot of information, and they are going to be want to play a part in their country. I remember writing an article 2011, I think, or 12, about what I call the Saudi model. And the Saudi model I was talking about at the time, Mohamed Morsi, the elected Egyptian president, was the scariest thing that happened to the Saudis.
Right.
And I said why? Because here is a religious Sunni,
yes,
son of a farmer, and educated, but most importantly, was elected to become the president of the largest Arab country. Now that seed, the idea that for every boy and young man in Riyadh, that if Mohamed Morsi, the son of a farmer, is being who is religious, is now the president of Egypt. This is a model for me to go by. I can also become a president. Why is this guy is the king?
Right.
So I mean, that's why they with the help of the Americans, they overthrow Mohamed Morsi, because the idea for Western countries to allow the Arab people to rule themselves is a scary thought. And because to them it's better to deal with one dictator, ugly dictator, no matter what, and then allow the people as well to reflect the regime of these countries' systems.
Ali Al-Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Inshallah, we can do another program in the future and discuss Saudi Arabia in depth once again. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ali Al-Ahmed? The Americans are desperately trying to consolidate the Saudi monarchy into one family, to replace the system of brotherly succession that has been the norm in the last 70 years, but which involves uncertainty and instability at the time of succession. Different factions in Washington had favored different candidates for this project, with the Democrats and the intelligence deep state favoring the now sidelined Mohammed bin Nayef, and the neocons and Israelis favoring Mohammed bin Salman. Bin Salman has now arrested bin Nayef, and it seems this issue has been settled for the time being, with even once very influential and elder princes such as Bandar bin Sultan now pledging allegiance to bin Salman with bended back, so they won't also end up as permanent guests in luxury hotels. If change is going to happen, it will most likely come from out of the Saudi tribe. Indeed, it seems that with the consolidation of power in one family, and with the mentioned concentration of power in the hands of people from the Najd region, the incentive for Hijazis, Eastern Shias, and Southern Najranis, Jizanis, and Asiris to seek a socio-political future beyond the tribal rule of the Saud family will intensify. It is also cynical and insulting to believe that the younger generation on the Arabian Peninsula will forego self-determination and elected government in return for such gimmicks as allowing Halloween celebrations and pop concerts. As the national liberation of once colonized peoples from around the world is reaching completion in the 21st century, and old feudal, tribal, and colonial structures are increasingly dissolving, there is no good reason why the people of the Arabian Peninsula should be an exception to this important historic process. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.